Basel III Endgame will make it harder for consumers to buy a house or a car. It'll hurt the small businesses that rely on loans to grow, and it'll reduce savings for people with money in pension funds. Regulators propose capital requirements would take a toll on families, seniors, farmers, and small businesses. Washington, scrap Basel III Endgame and start over.
Hello, listeners. This is Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, Democrats take power in the House, but are we any closer to reopening the parts of the federal government that have been shut down for nearly 2 weeks now? Plus, 2020 is starting to boil and bubble up in the background. At the beginning of 2019, we size up two big political figures who made news this week. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, she of the newly announced Presidential Exploratory Committee, and newly sworn in Utah Senator Mitt Romney, who wrote an explosive Washington Post op-ed criticizing President Trump on the eve of his swearing in. As always, we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday. That's January 3rd this week. So it's all up to date as of then, as the new Congress gets sworn in. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests, the inimitable Charlie Mattesian, senior politics editor at Politico. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
Happy 2019.
Thank you.
And here from Politico's White House team, Nerdcast regular Nancy Cook. Nancy, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Time for our first data point, 13. As of this conversation, a quarter of the federal government has been closed now for 13 days. No missed paychecks for government workers yet, but there could be very soon. They're on the horizon. So, Nancy, let's start broad. Is there any end in sight for this government shutdown?
I do not see any end in sight immediately. And I spent all day yesterday at the White House. It was a real shock. I'd been on vacation for 12 days and came back and was plunged back into Washington immediately. But when I was there...
Had anything changed in those 12 days?
Well, that was funny. Nothing had really changed.
That's the real shock.
Actually.
You come back from vacation, you expect to have to read up on all these developments that happened.
Right.
That's crazy.
It was crazy. And what was also crazy was that it was like a busy day. Like there was a lot of stuff that was happening. Trump had this crazy cabinet meeting and congressional leaders came over to the White House allegedly to negotiate about the shutdown. But actually, by the end of the day, nothing had changed at all. And I think that, congressional leaders are supposed to go back to the White House, or at least Republicans are on Friday. But to me, it just signaled yesterday really signaled that, you know, the shutdown is not going to be resolved likely by the end of this week. And when I talked to some administration officials last night, to me, it seemed like they're starting to privately sort of feel the heat of the shutdown. And the next marker that they have in their mind is next Friday, which is January 11th, which will be when people start to miss paychecks, because that's the next federal pay period.
Got it.
And so, but that's still like over a week away. And Trump made it clear during a cabinet meeting that this would go on as long as it needed, as long as it was possible, as long as it was needed.
It could be a long time, and it could be quickly. It could be a long time. It's too important a subject to walk away from.
And Democrats also made it clear, you know, they came out and spoke to White House reporters after they had met with the president and some other top White House officials.
At our last meeting, the president said, "I am going to shut the government down." They are now feeling the heat. It is not helping the president. It is not helping the Republicans to be the owners of this shutdown. Today we gave them an opportunity to get out of that and open up the government as we debate border security.
They made it clear that, you know, they feel like they have leverage in this and they want to fund the government, but they don't feel like they need to give Trump money for this border wall. And they made that very clear yesterday. And so there's just like this total impasse at this point.
Right. Well, so the shutdown starts in mid to late December when Republicans control both houses of Congress, but they still don't have the votes to fund the government with the wall. Now, today, Democrats take over control of the House of Representatives. And so it does seem like they're getting more cards in their hand as, you know, in the 30 minutes, so to speak.
And Nancy Pelosi, too, made it clear yesterday at the White House that she's going to pull a huge power play and power move today. And basically, she's going to introduce bills to fund the government that Republicans in the past have overwhelmingly supported. And that's kind of the Democrats' plan to put Trump and Republicans back on their heels. And there was a lot of talk of that. You know, we're putting forth bills that the Senate already voted in favor of. These are funding bills, and we don't see why you won't now approve them. Trump, meanwhile, is being privately counseled by Mick Mulvaney, his new acting chief of staff, and some other top White House officials, you know, not to take any short-term funding bill for the Department of Homeland Security, which is one of the agencies that shut down. And so even Trump top advisors are sort of urging him to keep up his stance. So that's why I don't just see, that's why I don't see it ending anytime soon.
Charlie, where are the pressure points that you see that could force something to change? As Nancy said, you know, she was here and then left and came back, and everything was still the same. Obviously, Democrats taking control of the House is a big step. But what Nancy mentioned, the federal workers' paychecks that could be missed on January 11th if this is still going on. What else exists out there that you think could pressure these sides? Because Trump is very insistent on this wall funding or steel slats or whatever it is that he's talking about recently. Democrats are emboldened by the sweeping midterm victories that they just enjoyed that have swept them into power. What gives?
Yeah, I mean, there's that next road marker that Nancy mentioned, the federal pay, but I don't see a whole lot of compromise points. I mean, in a lot of ways, the president has painted himself into a corner. I don't think it was well thought out strategy in the beginning, and now all of a sudden he understands that the base would be outraged if he gives in an inch. Yet on the other side, the first thing the new Democratic majority in the House does will not be caving on the border wall, and in fact, they're not going to move at all. Because what was the preliminary offer of, you know, $1.3 billion for fencing from the Democrats? And that prompted liberal outrage among those who wanted not a single dollar for a border barrier. And so all of a sudden, you begin to see how the trenches have been dug, and you don't see a lot of room for compromise. And that's why I tend to think that this will drag on.
For maybe a while.
Yeah, because I just don't see where do you meet on this. Trump can't give anything because of the way he's misplayed his hand. And on the left, the Democrats are ascendant, and their first move will not be to cave on this.
I think that the way it could end is, you know, Trump is very ideologically flexible and also very good at marketing. And so it could end that in that, you know, he gets like a little bit more, maybe not for the wall, but for border security, and he casts it as a win. And I think that may be what will end up happening, although it's so hard to speculate with politics and this White House in particular, that maybe what will end up having to happen is that he casts something very small that he's given as like a huge victory.
That's usually how these things have resolved in the past, right? Both sides find something to like about moving past a shutdown or whatever happens to be the sticking point issue in Congress.
And then both claim victory. But I think Nancy's right here. I mean, that's the super smart observation that you have, which is here, I don't even know that Trump will get much of anything at all, but he will be forced to frame it as a victory no matter what it is.
Right. And it's also so tricky because, you know, he's sending up these negotiators like Mulvaney. You know, Vice President Pence is leading the negotiations for the White House. Jared Kushner is involved. Shahira Knight, the head of legislative affairs. So he's sending them up to the Hill. He did before Christmas, so that they could make different offers and to the congressional leaders, the Democrats. But then he will say something in a cabinet meeting that's like totally different. And so
undercutting
really,
his own negotiators.
Right. And so what we saw yesterday, you know, when congressional leaders came to the White House, you know, I talked to people who were in the room. They had a meeting in the Situation Room that was supposed to be a briefing on immigration. But basically, Pelosi and Schumer just, you know, cut off the briefing from the officials and just tried to negotiate directly with Trump, because there's a feeling on the part of the Democrats that, like, why would I waste my time with anyone else when Trump tweets or makes a comment and the negotiations goes off the rails? And so there's a sense that it only matters if you deal with him directly.
And that's how we got here in the first place, right?
Absolutely.
This shutdown was not supposed to happen until Trump kind of performed, I guess it wasn't even, it was like a series of U-turns basically in the last week leading up to December 21st. And now here we are.
Yeah, and the last week was supposed to be sort of this glide into Christmas. You know, he was going to go to Mar-a-Lago for basically 2 weeks. You know, he named a new acting chief of staff. But then what happened is, you know, some far right members in the House, like Jim Jordans and Mark Meadows, got a hold of him. And then also a lot of congressional conservative commentators, really started to nail him on border funding. And suddenly what we thought was going to be like smooth sailing Christmas holiday just turned on its head. But it happened quickly.
And the important thing to keep in mind is this is what the Republican base cares the most about. When you look at the list of when pollsters frame it in terms of what issues matter most to you or you care most about or you're paying most attention to, however it's framed, they're different in each party. What the Democrats care about is different than what Republicans care about. And you see immigration and border security, however you frame it, rates really high for Republicans. And that's why the president had to draw a line. I think he was probably surprised by the ferocity of the outrage to him not getting his border money.
Well, and I definitely think that Trump campaign officials feel like immigration is going to continue to be a very winning message for them heading into 2020. And so they want to really set the stage for that. The tricky thing is that in order to win the presidency next time, Trump is going to need to appeal to people just beyond his base. And it's unclear to me when he does moves like this, how that appeals to independents or suburban women, you know, groups that he lost, that Republicans lost with in the midterms.
This is a problem a lot of politicians face, right? They think that everyone who voted for them is their base and that's their starting point for the next time when, in fact, we know that it's often not the case. And we saw, the House results speak for themselves, right? That's a national election that swung badly against the party as Trump was banging the drum on immigration in the final weeks of October.
But I think there's a big difference here in that Trump has not operated like a conventional politician in the sense that he came in with a smaller base. Granted, it's a harder base that is immovable in many ways and unchanging, but he never expanded it, at least with other presidents, whether it was on the left or the right. You began with your base and then you slowly expanded as you went over time. He has not moved to expand it and has shown no growth whatsoever in expanding his base since he took the office.
And that's why we are where we are, right? So we'll keep an eye on this. Maybe we'll have 4 or 5 more shutdown segments over the next weeks, depending on how long this drags on. Nancy, thank you so much for coming to talk us through this.
Of course. Anytime. Thanks, Scott.
All right, on to our next data point, which is 4. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren will visit 4 cities in Iowa this weekend. That comes after her Monday announcement, that was New Year's Eve, that she is launching a 2020 exploratory committee. And then later this week, we saw Mitt Romney, the 2012 Republican presidential nominee, who's being sworn in today as a U.S. senator from Utah, published a blistering piece in The Washington Post saying that while he agrees with some of the president's policies, he thinks that President Donald Trump has not risen to the office. And the language he used there and some of the language he used in discussing the piece on TV afterwards is enough to raise the question of whether Romney himself or maybe someone else might challenge Trump for the Republican mantle in 2020. Charlie's sticking around with us, and we've got political reporter Alex Eisenstadt with us in the studio to talk through this one. Alex, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. Let's start with Elizabeth Warren, though. Charlie, she's been sending signals for months, probably the strongest signals, the most clear signals of any Democrat, that she's going to be a presidential candidate. So can you recap some of the things that she's doing that have led us to this moment of the exploratory committee launch?
Sure. It wasn't a surprise in any way because Elizabeth Warren has been forging a 2020 machine for some time now. She began well before the midterms. And one of the reasons I think it didn't get a tremendous amount of publicity was because she was also simultaneously running for re-election back home in Massachusetts. So she couldn't really cut a high profile in the early presidential states in the way that some of the other 2020 Democratic contenders could afford to go out there and be seen. But while she was campaigning for re-election back home in Massachusetts, she was pouring money into building out a digital infrastructure. And keep in mind, she was already built for a presidential campaign in part because of her online fundraising base. She's able to just mint money from small donors and has shown that talent since coming to the Senate. And so she has been in many ways quietly preparing. Even before the midterms happened in November, there were quiet discussions with potential staffers for this new campaign, and there were endorsements. She was making calls to some unsuccessful candidates, even to successful candidates. I know she called some of the upset primary winners earlier this year. Those things weren't reported, but they were all part of building, I think, the portfolio to prepare to run, and which is, you know, essentially what she's doing right now.
It's not enough just to talk the talk. We've actually got to be willing to get out and walk the walk.
Kind of going from being a member of the party to a leader of the party, or someone who could be seen as a leader of the party.
And somebody who's able to get out of the starting blocks with a potentially enormous field of 20 candidates. I mean, she was always going to be more distinguished in a lot of ways than some of the people in the field. But this and also the timing of the exploratory committee gets her out in front of everyone else.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that. I mean, I think given everything that you just said, we're not surprised that she is running, or I guess technically exploring at this point, right? But did the timing surprise you at all? 8:30 a.m. on New Year's Eve?
I would like to say, no, it didn't surprise me, but that was in part because of the intrepid reporting of Natasha Kareki, who knew this was going to happen. What was interesting is, though, that it gives, in some ways, Warren has a head start on everyone else, because she has a head start literally because she announced before everyone else. And there, keep in mind, we're about to enter a window, about a 6-week window, in which we're going to see some top tier candidates announce their presidential bids. So she gets out in front of all of the others, whether it's Cory Booker or Kirsten Gillibrand or Kamala Harris. She gets out in front of everybody and also has a head start with this digital infrastructure. And then yesterday, she rolled out four top flight hires out of Iowa that had, I think, people, you know, at least in Iowa, and certainly that are in the know about national politics and really understand the mechanics of winning elections, sort of you know, surprised at the show of strength with you know, supremely talented Iowa staffers and operatives.
I think the digital aspect of what you mentioned is especially interesting, that she's getting this first bite at the apple of bringing in online fundraising for 2020. And I think it's interesting also that she, despite everything we've said and how clear all these signals are, that she's launching an exploratory committee instead of just coming out and launching a presidential campaign. But what that does is it gives her another big moment later, right? She announces her exploratory committee. I'm sure she raised a ton of money on December 31st when she did that. Later, she's going to announce, hey, okay, now I'm officially running, and it's going to be another kind of big bonanza to get her email list excited to you know, rake in some donations, 15, 20, 30 bucks at a time, and it's just going to be another big day that she can capitalize on. Julian Castro is doing the same thing, right? He launched an exploratory committee in December, and when he launched, he said, and we're going to be making a big announcement on January 12th, I think. I don't think the big announcement is going to be that he's not running, right? But it's another chance to make to be the story of the day, to make a big media splash, to make a big online fundraising splash, to excite your base.
And that's going to be essential this year when you have so many candidates running and everyone trying to define their lane and also distinguish themselves from a field that will have, you know, some pretenders, but lots of legitimate, very accomplished contenders for the nomination.
Alex, I want to jump into Mitt Romney for a second, but I'm curious your perspective on all this, having covered the Republican side of things when the Republican Party was in this same moment in January 2015, moving into 2016, of when all these folks were launching their campaigns. Are there parallels there in terms of what people are trying to do, or is it really are the two parties kind of operating on the rules of the game different?
Well, I think what similarity you might see is sort of jostling over lanes. You remember back in 2016, you had Republicans fighting over, you had Rubio and Jeb Bush fighting over the establishment lane and maybe the Florida lane. You had Ted Cruz and Rand Paul fighting over the sort of conservative Tea Party lane. And so one of the things that's going to be interesting to see is how does someone like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, for example, how do they jostle over the progressive wing? Are they going to be putting out negative oppo on one another? Are they going to be attacking each other sort of behind the scenes early? That's going to be something that I think will be interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm. It strikes me so far, at least looking at the polling, that the lanes start a lot more muddled. on the Democratic side. You could see even early in 2015 that, you know, people who liked, say, Jeb Bush also voters I'm talking about in opinion polls, people who liked Jeb Bush also liked Chris Christie. A lot of them also liked Marco Rubio. They did not like Ted Cruz or Rand Paul and vice versa, right? It seems like there's a lot more overlap. It seems most of the Democrats who like Elizabeth Warren also like Bernie Sanders, but they also like Joe Biden. They also like, you know, go down the line to all 20. And it strikes me as we're starting in a little bit more muddled situation.
Yeah. And one thing about Warren's announcement on New Year's Eve, I know there was some attention paid to that. Some people were questioning whether it was a smart day to do that. What struck me was that she chose to pick a slow news day, and a lot of these people who are going to be looking, who are going to be announcing their campaigns, that's the day when they get a lot of attention. That's the day when they can get news coverage. But unlike in 2016, they're going to be competing against a president who's actually making a ton of news, not just every day, but every hour potentially. And so they're going to be competing in a really, not just among themselves to get attention, but really against a president who's dominating news cycle after news cycle after news cycle.
That's a really good point.
And they're also going to have to find unique ways to break through his stranglehold on the news cycle.
Right.
I mean, Trump will, as we've seen, will do anything at any moment, and no matter how unconventional or perhaps undignified, no matter what it is. And so you have to be a sort of unique candidate either to counter that or at least to somehow share a news cycle with that kind of politician.
That's a great point. It's going to be fascinating to watch as more of these candidates launch and otherwise get off the ground. All right, on to Mitt Romney. Alex, recap what was in this op-ed in the Washington Post that caused so much hullabaloo yesterday. It was very noteworthy for how new senator stepping in, challenging the leader of his party directly. Of course, Mitt Romney is not your typical senator.
Right. It was a op-ed that focused really kind of broadly on this notion of Trump's character and that he had kind of fallen short of meeting the mantle of leading the country. And it also focused heavily on foreign policy, which is, of course, an area that Mitt Romney is pretty focused on. There was a time, actually, when Trump was considering him to become Secretary of State, but Romney expressed concern about the departure of Jim Mattis. He expressed concern about the Syria troop pullout. And so it really – these are themes that Romney has actually been sounding for some time about President Trump, but it was striking to see it, I think, in an op-ed format, to see it in sort of a formal newspaper setting and not just, say, a tweet, which is what Romney has been doing in recent months.
This sparked a lot of conversation on Wednesday about, is Mitt Romney going to run for president again? He was asked directly about it on TV and he said no. But what do you think this means in terms of the possibility that Trump could face a challenger of some sort?
Well, the timing is interesting because, you know, over the last month, there sort of seems to be growing concern among Republican Party elites about Trump. And this is sort of something that seems to have really intensified following Mattis's departure, following the Syria pullout,
following the midterms.
Following the midterms. Of course, these are all sort of private conversations, right? You still don't get many Republican senators coming out and speaking in a sort of consistent, forceful way against the president. But you have sort of seen a little bit of an uptick in criticism in recent weeks. And so the fact that Romney's op-ed dovetailed with this, it sort of led to kind of an increase in speculation that, look, what kind of primary could Donald Trump face heading into 2020? Could he face a symbolic one? Could he face a real one? Who would run against him, and what would it look like?
Yeah. Do you take Romney's denial that he's interested in running at face value in 2020?
You know, talking to his people, they say that they are insistent that he is not looking to run against Donald Trump. They say it very, very, very forcefully that he is not looking to run. And so I think that, you know, you have to take that seriously, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence to suggest that he's looking to run against President Trump, and if he did, he would certainly have probably a pretty uphill climb at this point, just because Romney isn't necessarily where most of the Republican Party is anymore.
Mm-hmm. It seems like anyone would have an uphill climb.
Right.
Alex, there's a subplot that you reported on here that's really interesting, involving the Republican National Committee chairwoman, the artist formerly known as Ronna Romney McDaniel. now just goes by Ronna McDaniel, right. But she's Mitt Romney's niece. And you reported that Romney called her himself to say, I guess on Tuesday night, it's like, hey, by the way, I'm going to be launching a broadside at your boss in the Washington Post.
Right. That's basically what happened. And Ronna McDaniel was immediately frustrated by that. She knew, based upon my reporting, that she wanted to push back publicly against her uncle. And so what she did was on Tuesday evening, as this piece was about to hit print, she spoke by phone with President Trump, and she basically said, look, my uncle is going to be out with an op-ed pretty soon that just absolutely savages you. And so what you saw in the coming hours was that evening after the op-ed was published, she put out a tweet sort of defending the president. And then Wednesday morning, as this op-ed sort of dominated the news cycle, she put out a more forceful tweet sort of scolding Mitt Romney for his op-ed.
Round one, fight.
It's going to be interesting to watch how Romney keeps going in the Senate. I mean, he said yesterday in response to this that he's not going to be a daily commentator on President Trump, but that he is going to speak out when he thinks it's necessary. And with people like Jeff Flake and Bob Corker, who have previously been the president's biggest critics among Senate Republicans, leaving with the new Congress being sworn in, it's going to be very interesting to see what role Romney plays.
But it's also interesting because of the unusual base that he has to operate from. I mean, what tends to be overlooked is that Flake and Corker really had no room to maneuver once they staked out their position, meaning they were intent on being contrarians and fighting the president on the issues that mattered to them. And it cost them both politically to the point where they were non-viable as reelection candidates in the end because the state parties were elsewhere. But Utah is very unique in that Trump has never had very much support among the LDS community. You saw this in the primaries. You even saw this in the general election. Mormons just never took to Donald Trump and still haven't, certainly not in large numbers. I mean, you see some warming toward the president, but there's still a reticence among the Republican, among the various Republican constituencies. There's still softness. There's still a lot of weakness with Donald Trump when it comes to Utah Republicans, and I think that gives Romney a little bit of an advantage in that because in some ways he's an exalted figure in Utah, and because it's a state that is very conservative and very Republican, yet not ultra pro Trumpy, that will give him some leeway and room to maneuver that other politicians might not have had.
That's a great point. Unique national profile and megaphone, but also unique base at home to back it up.
Exactly.
It's going to be fun to watch. Alex, thank you so much for talking to us about it. And Charlie, thank you as always.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. As usual, we are going to turn things over briefly here at the end of the podcast to one Nerdcast superfan. Jonathan Blunden from the UK is going to help us out with the credits this week.
Nerdcast is produced by Mercadia Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcasts and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Jonathan. Listeners, we found Jonathan because he emailed in to say he was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, please let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you so much for listening this week. We will talk to you again next week.